Hey, Betties. Welcome to the Better Podcast. It's your host, Dr. Stephanie. It is geeky magic time where I step away from the interviews and just talk to you. It's just going to be me and you today. And these episodes, I'm going to bring you personal insights, frequently asked questions, topic du jour in a more condensed, quick, and actionable way. I go hard on the geek, wrap it up with sprinkles and magic for you to do and be better.
Hey, Betties. Well, looks like we have a bit of a theme this week around glucose and sugar, because I want to follow up the conversation, this Monday's episode conversation with Dr. Casey Means, and follow it up with some sugar science. So we're going to talk about glucose, we're going to talk about fructose today, and we're going to talk about some of the changes that it has on our metabolism and on our brain.
One of my goals this year is to make it my best year ever with my skin. And one of the ways that I'm doing that is with the Boncharge Red Light Neck and Chest Mask. Wrinkles, acne, scarring, skin roughness, loss of collagen and elastin happen in the face and in the neck and the décolletage area on our chest, where the skin is very thin and susceptible to skin damage. I think at this point, we're all pretty good about putting sunscreen on our face, but so many of us miss the neck and the chest area too. I use the Boncharge neck and chest mask daily for about 10 minutes in the morning while I'm checking emails. Their red and near infrared light waves together penetrate up to 5 to 10 centimeters below the skin's surface. The red light reaches the skin's top layers, and the NIR light targets the deeper tissues without UV exposure. And that's going to help reduce the fine lines, wrinkles, and to help ramp up collagen and elastin production. So I want you to head over and have your best skin with me this year. Go to boncharge.com/better. That's BETTER. And use the discount code BETTER at checkout. And that's going to give you 15% off your entire cart.
Transform your health and fitness with the Carol Bike, the smartest, most effective exercise backed by science. You can experience unparalleled results in just a minimum of 15 minutes per week, thanks to AI personalized workouts tailored to your age and your fitness level. You will increase fat loss, train up your strength and your speed, and have better energy, something that every woman, including myself, absolutely covets. I always say that women are the original biohackers. If there's a way for us to feel better and look better, we are all over it. Carol Bike, in my opinion, is one of the best pieces of cardio equipment that you can invest in. Studies prove that Carol helps you achieve a 12% increase in cardio fitness, lowers the risk of type 2 diabetes by 62%, and reduces blood pressure by 5% in as little as 8 weeks. Begin your transformation with the Carol Bike today and enjoy $100 off using the promo code BETTER for our beautiful Better Podcast listeners. That's BETTER. All you have to do is visit carolbike.com.
And there are many different types of sugar, right? But we're going to be talking about specifically glucose and fructose today. And we've talked about glucose and fructose on the podcast before, the conversation that I had with Dr. Robert Lustig, which has already made its way into the top 10 of my episodes, very popular episodes. You guys really loved it. And I thought that we might continue that conversation today. So when we are talking about glucose, it is important to establish, of course, that glucose is the molecule of life. Every single cell in our body uses glucose, and it's when glucose is absent, we can draw from glycogen stores to make glucose through the process of glycogenolysis, and we can synthesize glucose from exogenous substrates, obviously from carbohydrates, and also from proteins via gluconeogenesis, which is just the making, you know, when you break that word down, it just means the making of new glucose. And I wanted to talk a little bit about, I wanted to start our conversation today by highlighting fructose, because I think most people think that it's relatively benign. It sort of just acts just like glucose. And in fact, it really does have quite a different impact, both on our brain, which we'll talk about, but also on our hormones. And in particular, I want to talk about a couple of metabolic hormones. So I want to talk about fructose's impact on ghrelin signaling. So ghrelin is our hunger hormone. It's secreted by the stomach. Think of a gremlin, sounds like gremlin in the stomach. It signals that it's time to eat, okay? And when we look at the differences between glucose and fructose, so for example, when you have, let's say, an exogenous substrate of energy, you have some carbohydrates, maybe you have some, you know, proteins and fats in your meal. When you put glucose in the stomach, your hormone, that hunger hormone, ghrelin, is going to go down. So it's like, thanks a lot. I got what I needed. You know, I don't need to be around her anymore. And ghrelin goes away. By contrast, when you put fructose in the stomach, the ghrelin signaling does not change. And what happens is, of course, you know, when you're consuming this glucose, your brain doesn't know that you've eaten it, right? That ghrelin signaling doesn't attenuate. And of course, inevitably, what happens is you end up eating more. And that excess energy, which we're going to talk about in the context of the liver in a moment, but that excess energy has two fates, right? So one, if you are moving, so if you are, you know, let's say going for a walk or you're exercising or there's some type of demand from the myocyte, we can bring the sugar in to be burned. Or as it is the case with most consumption of fructose, there's going to be lipogenesis and it's going to be stored as fat. So lipo and genesis, meaning the making of new fat. So we know that it has effects on your ghrelin signaling, which is your hunger hormone. It also, fructose also has effects on your leptin hormone, which is leptin is a fat derived hormone secreted from the adipose tissue. And it does a couple of different things. I've talked about leptin and leptin resistance extensively in my book, The Betty Body. But in the context of leptin, I actually want to talk about the impact that it has on brain development and cognition. So when we are consuming a lot of fructose, so fructose, and actually I apologize, I didn't mention this at the outset of our conversation, but when we look at the difference between glucose and fructose, so glucose is a 6-carbon ring structure. It's like a circle of carbons. And fructose is a 5-carbon ring structure. So even though they sort of look like cousins, and they are metabolized quite differently in the body. So when we're consuming a lot of fructose, we are inducing insulin resistance and hyperinsulinemia, so an increased secretion of insulin from the beta cells in the pancreas. And this will eventually block leptin's action. So leptin is such a cool hormone. So it's involved in the Betty Body. I say leptin says put the fork down, right? So it's involved in satiety and feeling full. So ghrelin and leptin sort of act like yin and yang, right? Ghrelin is secreted. It's like, hey, I'm hungry, right? You eat, and leptin's like, hey, we're done eating. But leptin also has other impacts on brain development and cognition. So when you are consuming too much fructose, it will block leptin's actions to essentially permit neurons to branch out and connect. Like, it's literally preventing dendritic, the dendrites are basically branches of the neurons that make other little connections. If you ever lie at the bottom of a tree, as I often do, and you look up at the tree branches, there's sort of the main trunk, and then you get these sort of larger branches. And then if you follow a branch all the way to the end, or a tree all the way to the end, it makes all of these smaller little branches. That's actually very similar to our brain structure when we think of that, about this in the context of dendrites. And actually, just to be a little word nerd here, dendrite, which is the branching of these neurons, it has its root word dendros from the Greek word tree. So dendritic communication. So when you have too much fructose consumption, it will prevent neurons from making these communications between each other, which of course can lead to numerous cognitive deficits. We've talked to Dr. Dale Bredesen on the podcast with Alzheimer's and this lack of total neuronal volume and lack of, both gray matter and white matter volume. Of course, last week's Geeky Magic, I was talking about some of the changes that we see in menopause and the brain with the gray and the white matter. And when you're consuming a lot of fructose, it is literally going to kibosh your brain's volume. And wait, there's more. Fructose also inhibits, and you guys all know how much I love this baby, it inhibits brain-derived neurotrophic factor, BDNF. So if you're new to that term, BDNF, or brain-derived neurotrophic factor, is essentially miracle grow for the brain. So it promotes neurogenesis, which is the birth of new neurons, and that usually will happen in the gray matter of the brain. And it's also neuroprotective, meaning that it protects the stuff that you already have. And fructose inhibits BDNF in places like the hippocampus. Now, the hippocampus is it's a memory center. So learning and memory is often attributed to this area in the brain called the hippocampus. And this is a problem, right? So when we think about often when we, if you look at surveys, you know, people would rather get diseases like cancer or have strokes than get diseases like Alzheimer's, because we know one of the hallmarks of Alzheimer's in terms of its clinical presentation is that it not only selectively targets the hippocampus, but it essentially erases your life from your memory banks. And I cannot think, I'm actually kind of getting a little choked up even saying this. Like, I cannot even think of a worse disease than having lived for 70 years or 80 years or 90 years and literally not remembering the people around you. Like, that is just the most cruel twists of fate. And a lot of that is driven by excess fructose consumption. Not done yet, unfortunately. So I also want to talk about fructose in terms of brain, in terms of the reward centers, the effects that it has on the reward centers of the brain. Now, obviously we know glucose is metabolized in the brain for energy, and even in a state of ketosis. So even when you are using ketone bodies as the primary substrate for energy in the brain, there is still going to be some baseline glucose metabolism in the brain. We know that, like, your brain will never 100% run on ketone bodies. So when we look at glucose, for example, and we take pictures of the areas that, you know, metabolize glucose, we are going to see that, you know, areas in the brain like the sensory motor cortex. So basically the motor cortex, which is sort of at the front part of the brain, the sensory cortex, which is just kind of right behind it. Those are really big glucose gobblers, and we'll also see a high affinity in the basal ganglia. Now, fructose, on the other hand, will specifically light up. So if you're looking at this on a functional MRI, for example, it's going to specifically light up the reward center. And you may have heard the saying, you know, sugar is as bad for you as cocaine. And the reason, and we want to get a little bit more specific, because it's not necessarily glucose, although excess glucose can have a hedonic nature to it. And it usually comes, it's actually hard with real whole foods to have a lot of glucose, unless you're like literally throwing back gallons of blackberries. And it's like, okay, the fiber is going to help with the satiety signal. Like, it's going to be gross, right? But when we are having processed foods, which almost all processed foods, if it comes in a bag, it comes in a box, or it's wrapped, like basically you can't pick it from a tree or harvest it from a leaf or pull it from the ground. This is a processed food. Okay. So fructose has been shown to induce the same physiology, like to light up these reward centers that, more hedonic items like, you know, cocaine and heroin and nicotine and alcohol, also generates. So it's not necessarily that whole foods like, you know, foods that have that are glucose containing will, light up these areas. It's more specifically the processed sugar, like the fructose, that is going to have, this addictive type of behavior. And if you listen to the Geeky Magics, like the good Betty that you are, of course, you know that in previous Geeky Magics, I've talked about desire and dopamine and the interplay between that feeling and what happens to the brain, like what that dopaminergic response is. And when you're ingesting lots and lots of fructose, these compounds that are lighting up these reward signals, you're also going to get a flurry of dopamine secretion. In other words, you are going to want to repeat the behavior, right, that brought about that dopaminergic secretion in the first place, pardon me. So if it was a, you know, processed food, you are much more likely to seek out that food again and again and again in order to get that dopamine hit. It's like the metabolic equivalent of getting 1,000 likes on Instagram in one time, right? You're going to be like, hey, wow, that felt really great. What is it that I did? What did I post on Instagram that got me those likes? I should do that again. Same is true with the food. You're like, hey, that felt really great. What is it about those chips or that, you know, those cookies or that whatever, that made me, you know, that made me feel so good? I want to go and do that again. Now, interestingly, because our bodies, like, we must have reverence for the feedback loops that our body has, the more sugar that you give to someone, so the more fructose that you might give or processed sugar that you give someone, or even literally just the white powdery stuff, there's a desensitization that happens. So this like down regulation of response to the food, so that the more that we have it, the more that we have sugar, right? Your taste buds actually become desensitized, right? It doesn't taste quite as sweet. And this is actually one of the things I often hear in people who have gone through my Estima diet is that, you know, they do the keto, they lower the carbohydrates, you know, for an extended period of time or what have you. And then maybe they go to a wedding, for example, or they go to a family function or there's a celebratory event and they have, let's say, a piece of wedding cake or some cheesecake, whatever it is. And what they'll come back and report to me the next week is like, hot damn, that was so insulting to my palate. Like it was so sweet and gross that I couldn't finish it. And what my ladies will often report is like, in previous, like prior to starting the Estima diet, I could have had 2 or 3 pieces of pie, right? I could have had 2 or 3 slices of cheesecake or 2 or 3 pieces of wedding cake, because what happens, of course, is when you don't have those sweets and then you reintroduce it to the diet, you are so sensitized to the sweet that it's like an insult to your palate. It's an insult to your palate. Versus when you are constantly having those sweets, there's this desensitization that happens. So you need to eat more to get the same hit, right? And of course, you know, there's this dissatisfaction that you get with just one piece of wedding cake, right? You need to have another and perhaps even another in order to get that same dopaminergic response that you once did. And of course, this is very true for the neurochemical cascade as well, right? There's a desensitization of the dopamine receptors because the dopamine receptors become less sensitive because it's like, oh, this old song and dance again. Like here's the cheesecake song and dance again. Like I can't always be giving this girl all the dopamine all the times. I'm sure that's exactly what the meeting between the dopamine receptors happen, right? So it's an interesting phenomenon because when we are consuming fructose on the regular, it's obviously very difficult to realize that this is happening, that this desensitization is happening, but it can and predictably and necessarily does in order to conserve, in many ways, the dopamine system. And The last thing I want to mention in terms of brain health, because, you know, I love to talk about the brain, especially as it relates to women, is this, this brain metabolism. Fructose will alter brain metabolism in that it will affect our astrocytes. So when we think about the brain, we have sort of two main, clearly an oversimplification, but we have two types of cells. We have neurons, which I've talked about, neuronal cells and the gray white matter and the axons extending into the white matter. And then we also have almost the supporting cells, if you will. These are called the astrocytes, right? And this will comprise of many different types of cells, but they basically nourish and protect the neurons. And we know that we have more astrocytes than we do neurons. And what happens is when we're consuming lots and lots of fructose, we are driving a couple of important metabolic processes that I wanted to discuss: glycation in particular, oxidative stress, and mitochondrial damage. Now, you may have heard of these words before, so this may be a bit of a review for you, but glycation is essentially the reason why we age. It is the wrinkles that we get. It's the gray hairs that we get. It's the cataracts in the eyes. It's the stiff joints. And basically, glycation, we're going to talk about this in the context of the Maillard reaction, is the accelerator to aging. So what is the Maillard reaction? Happens in all of us. But basically, the Maillard reaction needs two molecules essentially to occur. It needs a carbohydrate. So it's either going to be a glucose or fructose, and it also needs an amino acid. And when you have these two things together, the protein will start to essentially brown and become less flexible. So the protein loses its flexibility. It can become deformed. It can fold in on itself. There's a lot of different things that can happen with a glycated cell. And so the question with the Maillard reaction in particular, this browning that happens when you have an amino acid and a fructose molecule or amino acid or excess glucose, is that it's going to happen at an accelerated rate. Now, remember I mentioned glucose has a 6-member structure ring. So it's more stable than the five carbon member ring of fructose. So it will engage in this Maillard reaction slower than the fructose, that 5-member carbon ring. And the 5-member carbon ring, having one less carbon than 6, is much more easily broken apart. And what we know is that fructose, when we have a glycated protein with fructose, it will engage in the Maillard reaction 7 times faster than glucose. And I believe that we always talk about, you know, dogs, that we talk about like their dog years, like one of their years is like 7 of ours. Well, that's actually what happens with glucose. We are living like dogs, right? We basically are aging at a rate of 7 times faster than we really should. And of course, it also is going to generate more oxygen radicals. So this is kind of leading me into my conversation around oxidative stress. But before I get there, if you recall, if you've listened to my conversation with Dr. Robert Lustig, you may have heard him say, and it's, you know, rather crude, but it's true, you know, and this is in the context of the Maillard reaction, that, you know, you can put a chicken in the oven and you'll see it brown. Let's say you put it, you know, the temperature is 450 degrees Fahrenheit, and, you know, the chicken browns over the course of like 45, let's call it, to 60 minutes, maybe a little bit longer, depending on your oven strength, but let's call it 60 minutes for just for round numbers. And he also says, you know, albeit crudely, that humans also brown, but we brown at the rate of 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit. And we do that for about 72 years or so, right? So, you know, kind of a fun visual, or not so fun visual. But that's how we age, right? We engage in this Maillard reaction. And if we are consuming more crap, right? more of the carbonated beverages, the Coca-Colas and the artificial sweeteners and the processed foods and all that kind of stuff, we are going to be increasing glycation and accelerating that Maillard reaction. And just a little special props out to my hero, Cristiano Ronaldo, who I don't know if many of you follow soccer at all, but he was just recently at a press junket and was sitting, saw these two bottles of Coca-Cola and was so disgusted by their presence near him, he moved them exactly out of frame and then declared to the camera, drink water, not Coke. So, you know, we need more superstars like Ronaldo who are not afraid to make statements like that, because clearly when you are an athlete, you're not drinking garbage like that nutritionally toxic, absolute hogwash. So, but I digress. A little bit of current news for you there if you're following Euro. So let's move on to oxidative stress. So I was talking a little bit about this Maillard reaction generating lots and lots of oxygen radicals. And this is what we call oxidative stress. Now, oxidative stress is one of the trade-offs for cellular respiration. You cannot avoid it. You are always going to produce a certain amount of reactive oxygen species and oxidants as a result of producing ATP, which is our energetic currency in the cell. So it is part and parcel. It is a normal part of the Krebs cycle, but it is really the imbalance of these reactive oxygen species and our own baked in antioxidant defense system that I'm referring to here. So we have our own antioxidant defense system, which will sort of scavenge out and neutralize these ROS, these reactive oxygen species. And so through normal respiration, you know, you have, let's say with glucose, because that's very well known, very well documented. Of course, we consume, let's say, carbohydrates. The end product of that through the breakdown in the digestive system is glucose. Glucose then goes through glycolysis, becomes pyruvate. And then assuming the energetic needs of that cell don't exceed the energetic capacity of the Krebs cycle, the pyruvate will enter the Krebs cycle, eventually will go through the electron transport chain to produce ATP. This is called oxidative phosphorylation, okay?
I am incredibly bullish on sauna as a therapy for recovery, heart health, and overall aging well. I personally decided on an infrared sauna from Sunlighten because of the range of far wavelengths and near infrared wavelengths that it offers. Saunas help with detoxification and rejuvenation to rid your body of toxins. It helps with heart health by improving circulation, reducing blood pressure, and helping keep the arteries supple. It helps with muscle recovery by easing the tension and soreness to recover faster, and of course, stress reduction. With the warmth and the relaxation of sitting in a sauna, it's crucial for hormonal balance and achieving a state of well-being necessary for a strong physique and a strong mind. If you visit sunlighten.com/better and use code better to get a discount. That is sunlighten, sunlighten.com/better, and use code better at checkout.
So this is one of the things I want to highlight here is that in each of our cells, we have these subcellular organelles. They're called peroxisomes, and this is where that natural baked-in antioxidant defense system lives. And they are designed to essentially quash and quench, right, incoming oxygen radicals, and basically render them inert, so that they don't have that, they don't have the capacity to muck up the system and muck up the cell. But it is the ratio. So if we now have more oxygen radicals, so now we are speeding up that Maillard reaction. We are, you know, continuing to consume fructose unknowingly. We are producing and spitting out more of these oxygen radicals. Then eventually, this is going to outnumber the antioxidant defense system that we have, and this is now going to produce oxidative distress. Now, a certain amount of oxidative stress, I'm of the opinion, is actually really great for our cells, because when we are going through normal cellular respiration and we are having these reactive oxygen species, of course, it is going to tell our cells to level up and to fortify our natural antioxidant defense system. But when these oxygen radicals will supersede the ratio of our own natural antioxidants, it's going to cause that cellular dysfunction, right? It's going to cause structural damage to lipids, to the lipid layer of the cell, to proteins, to our DNA. And in the extreme, it's going to cause cell apoptosis or cell death. And of course, when this happens in the liver or this happens in the pancreas, you get diabetes, right? So this is, you know, and this is kind of a side note here, this is part of the reason why I advocate in my Estima diet that we need to be consuming vegetables and fruits that have colors. And I specifically say vegetables and fruits and not fruits and vegetables, because some people will just hear fruits and they'll say, oh, I should just have tons and tons of pineapple or tons and tons of strawberries or whatever. And it's, no, you should need to be having your vegetables first and then fruits after. So you want to be consuming vegetables that have colors, because the color, so things like, think like of the greens in the green leafy vegetables, the beautiful red in peppers, these are an indication that these plants contain antioxidants. Okay. So fruits, oh, I should say vegetables and fruits with color. And no, I don't agree with the current narrative that we need to eliminate vegetables and fruits from the diet. I think that vegetables are important. And of course, as I say that, I realize that there is nuance to that, especially when it comes to certain autoimmune conditions. But generally, for the general population, I would say we need more vegetables. Pretty easy to get fruits now, right? They come in those plastic, even though I don't like that they come in those plastic boxes, but they come in those plastic containers. Vegetables, we need a little bit more work, right? Like you can get the peppers, you can get the cucumbers, but then they don't just magically peel themselves. Oh, wouldn't that be great? Magically peel themselves or cut and chop themselves. You have to do that work, which is where I find most people, they tend to, you know, they'll buy the cucumber and then they throw it out 4 days later because it's gone bad. And so the last piece of cellular dysfunction that I wanted to address with excess glucose, but specifically fructose, is that it damages the gift that you got from your mama. And that is your mitochondria. Now, what a great Mother's Day card, wouldn't that be, right? So, you know, the saying, you know, it's like, shake what your mama gave you. Well, what your mama gave you was your mitochondria, right? That's the only thing that daddy can't give you. Your mother gives you your mitochondria. This is your bacterial lineage, comes from mama. Okay. And if you are drowning your mitochondria in fructose, mitochondrial dysfunction ensues, right? And truly, when you hear doctors like myself, or, you know, doctors speaking about chronic disease, what we're actually talking about is mitochondrial dysfunction. They are one and the same. So aside from the obvious signs, like, you know, the brain fog, the fatigue, the memory issues, joint pain, sluggishness, all those things that indicate poor energy, signs of poor mitochondrial dysfunction on labs are reflected in high uric acid levels and high homocysteine levels. And I'm reminded of my anatomy teacher who also always used to say homocysteine. I don't know why, but it's still in my brain. But homocysteine. And homocysteine should be completely cleared from the bloodstream, okay? Otherwise, it's going to build up and it's going to irritate the blood vessel and it's going to cause inflammation. And of course, high uric acid. Now I know Dr. David Perlmutter, who's also been on the pod, I know he's writing a book on, I mean, the title of his book is Drop Acid, which is so clever. I'm assuming that he's talking about uric acid. And I think that I can't wait to have him on the pod really to discuss that. But we really want to be thinking about our uric acid levels. And I write about uric acid levels as well in The Betty Body. We really want to make sure that if you are getting them checked, that they are under 5 milligrams per deciliter. Now, don't worry, I'm going to talk all about some labs that you can do in this podcast as well, but just wanted to throw that in there as well. And so all of this talk about the oxidation, the mitochondrial dysfunction, the glycation, the changes in brain function, the hedonic activation of brain centers, the derangement of our metabolic hormones like ghrelin and leptin. This is why it's important to highlight why this valiantly defended archaic view that a calorie is a calorie is just simply oversimplistic and marred, right? You know, fructose and glucose, they have the equivalent caloric assignment to them, right? But their effects on the brain and the body appear to be quite different. And, you know, this calorie is not a calorie. I mean, you can also bring that down to a carb is not a carb, right? For decades, the American Heart Association, emphasis intended, the American Diabetes Association and the American Medical Association, they advocated for a low fat diet, right? And obviously by definition, that means a high protein diet. And I'm not sure that that's such a good trade, right? I'm not sure that that's such a good trade because when, you know, when we look at carbohydrates, it's not just like there's one kind. It's just like when you say, women. It's like, hello, we are not this monolith. We're not all the same. Some of us are tall. Some of us are, you know, short. Some of us are big breasted. Some of us are, you know, president of the itty bitty titty committee. Some of us have thyroid dysfunction. Some of us have mitochondrial insufficiency. We have genetic polymorphisms that are different. Some of us have PCOS and some of us have estrogen dominance and on and on and on she goes, right? The same is true of a carbohydrate. You know what I mean? Like first, sugar and starch, both carbohydrates. That, like, so different, right? Sugars are, you know, monosaccharides and disaccharides, right? One or two, mono, di, right? One or two molecules. A starch is a polymer, so more than two, right? Poly, many, right? Many molecules. And, you know, sugar, either they either have one bond or no bonds to break. So they're digested oh so very easily, right? And absorbed oh so very easily from the duodenum. And especially if they've just been, if they're like processed food, like they've been liberated, right? From the food matrix. So they don't come with fibers. They don't come with fats. They don't come with protein. So I'm talking about the Coca-Colas or shall we say sodas, right? Not to name any names, but Coca-Cola, fruit juice, alcohol, right? Or if you listen to this Monday's episode, Dr. Casey Mean called them naked carbs, which I really liked. And usually carbs don't actually, with the very few exception of, I mean, even fruit has fiber. I'm trying to think of where carbohydrates are just glucose. It is very, very rare. And of course, when we look at sugars, easily digested, easily absorbed, starches, more bonds, right? And by their very nature, digested and absorbed much slower. And then even within starches, guys, like even within starches, different types of starches, right? I've talked a lot about resistant starches. So these are starches that resist digestion. Sometimes they're called prebiotic fibers. They act as food sources for the microbiome, which then spit out short chain fatty acids. We also have amylose, right? So these are more like brown foods like beans and legumes and lentils. And then we have the amylopectins, right? These are, we find these in like they're called the white devils, right? It's like the wheats, the pasta, the bread, the rice, the potatoes and stuff. So these are carbs that are generally absorbed much quicker. So amylose, the brown foods, right? The beans, the lentils, that stuff tend to be better for you. And I have some thoughts about lentils and legumes that we'll, like, for the sake of time, we'll leave out for now. But basically it's much slower in terms of its digestion, much slower in terms of its absorption. And of course, therefore is going to have a different insulinergic response. Whereas the amylopectin, those white devils, right? They are going to basically release glucose, or if you're having some processed foods, it's going to be fructose much faster. It's going to flood the liver, like literally going to flood the liver. And she's going to be like, what the hell, guys? Like what's all this fructose going to be here? And what's doing here? And generate a bigger insulin response. So I say this because I hate this a calorie is a calorie argument. I really like is a strong word to use the H word, but I do hate it because it is so simple and it just demonstrates like flea brain thinking. Okay. It's just like you can't say women are like this. Men are like this, right? Because we know that each woman is, you know, we are, first of all, we're not little men, right? But there's different hormonal, even within the same woman, she has a varying and ever-changing hormonal milieu, not only in her reproductive years, but over the arc of her life. She has genetic predispositions, epigenetic factors that we don't. So this thing like, oh, calories are just calories. Like, please sit down and stop talking. So I shall get off my soapbox and continue with what I wanted to tell you, which is coming back to fructose, which is, you know, we talked this week with Casey around monitoring glucose. Like it's really easy to monitor glucose, right? So you can, if you wanted to look at your, you know, in a blood draw, you might look at HbA1c or hemoglobin A1c, which is measuring glycation. We talked with Casey around Levels, which is a continuous glucose monitor. And of course there are others, but Levels is really looking like it is just, you know, the board of directors is just like this, a star-studded lineup of many better guests actually. And we know, you know, when we do, you know, blood draws, when we do breath tests, even like if you use the lumen, for example, you know how many ketone bodies you're producing, right? So we can directly measure things like glucose and ketone bodies, but we cannot directly measure fructose. And this is because, and this is important for you to understand, because this is where people get a little messed up. Like, isn't it just the same thing? Like, isn't it just go through the same, you know, metabolic pathway? No. Fructose can only be metabolized in the liver. So there's kind of this like backdoor metabolism that fructose has. And that's because the liver has a special transporter. It's called the GLUT5 transporter. We won't get into those details now because I suspect that there's only two people listening to the podcast at this point. But every time a fructose molecule enters a liver cell, it has to be phosphorylated. So just hang on with the science for me. We're going to talk a little science right now. But basically that means that the fructose has to, we have to add a phosphate group to it. So it which is called phosphorylation. So enters through the GLUT5 transporter, fructose is phosphorylated, and now it goes from fructose to fructose 1-phosphate. So the phosphate is bound at the first carbon, the first position. And the phosphate, so remember I said that it has to be phosphorylated, we add a phosphate group to it. It's donated but from ATP. So if you remember ATP, this is adenosine triphosphate. So triphosphate, 3 phosphates, it gives up one of its phosphates for this damn fructose. Okay. So your energy is being sacrificed here for fructose metabolism. And so now we have ATP lost one of its P's, right? Sounds like a Dr. Seuss novel. And now ATP becomes, God, I'm such a nerd. ATP becomes ADP, adenosine diphosphate. Phosphate. Okay. And then it will also, so ADP now is also going to lose another P. So it's going to go to AMP. So now we're at adenosine monophosphate. Then it downgrades again to inositol monophosphate. So it's IMP. And then finally to uric acid. Okay. So I know that was a lot, but I wanted to, tell you why uric acid is related to fructose consumption. And of course, we know in the literature that serum uric acid, so if we have that uric acid level higher than 5 milligrams per deciliter, particularly in children and adolescents, this correlates with sugary beverage consumption. This correlates with anxiety. It correlates with attention deficit disorder, inability to focus. And there have been other researchers specifically around uric acid showing that uric acid is also an inhibitor of something called endothelial nitric oxide synthase, which is basically the It's like the ability for our arteries to vacillate and dilate. So it's the ability, it causes essentially stiffness in the artery. So it restricts the ability of the artery to be more flexible and pliable. So when we measure serum uric acid levels, that can give you an indirect idea of how well your liver is metabolizing fructose. Okay. And, you know, if you're consuming, maybe you're consuming too much fructose, et cetera. So I wanted to give you a couple of action items. I know this has been a little sciencey, a little nerd sermon here, but I wanted to talk a little bit about some labs that you might explore. So I've already given you the serum uric acid under 5 milligrams per deciliter. We also want to look at some, I also like to look at liver, the transferases. So there are two transferases in particular. One is ALT or alanine aminotransferase. And this is relatively standard. It's not like a specialized test or whatever. And it's reasonably sensitive, reasonably specific for measuring the degree of liver fat. Because the other thing I haven't gotten into, but you should listen to the conversation with Dr. Robert Lustig, is that excess fructose consumption has been linked to fatty liver disease, or as he calls it, human foie gras. I mean, what a name, but fatty liver disease, right? When we're consuming excess fructose, we have this de novo lipogenesis in the hepatocytes, which end up causing this accumulation of fat in the liver. So ALT, the other transferase, or actually before I say that, you want the number under 25. If it's over 25, definitely speak to your doctor about further inquiry, maybe an ultrasound, or there'll be other things that they might talk to you about. Same thing with AST. So that's the other transferase, and that's aspartate aminotransferase. And this is a measure of mitochondrial function. So we talked about mitochondrial dysfunction today. And AST levels, they will rise either with acute alcohol consumption, even acetaminophen consumption. Like some people will have a hard time detoxifying and metabolizing acetaminophen. And also with HEP, right? Hepatitis, any cause of hepatitis. And if AST is elevated, this is the acute. So I like to look at AST as like the acute stressor to the liver. So if that's elevated, your liver is like either, you know, there's an infection or there's some sort of toxin related thing, either acetaminophen or other drugs or some kind of assault. If your ALT, the alanine, the alanine aminotransferase or ALT, this is more of a chronic metabolic assault, right? So this is more indicative of potentially fatty liver accumulation. And of course, if both are elevated, then you really want to be doing further inquiry with your doctor to look for like any other signs of liver damage. So those are some blood tests that you can run. You can do a HOMA-IR, which is a homeostatic model of assessment for insulin resistance. It's a calculation. This assesses your risk for diabetes. It's basically, we're using a little bit of math here, but it's glucose. It's like your glucose level times your insulin level. And then you divide that by 405. And usually the range, anything less than 2.8 is considered excellent. Anything higher than 4.3 is not great. 4.3 is often kind of the mean that we see. We often see this as the average. So you wanna get under 4.3. I would say that my preference for that would be I would like it to be, you know, it's a little tighter for me. I would like it to be not just the average. I want you to be exceptional. But of course, we want to take into account like familial history and, you know, there's a lot of things to take into account. So those are some of the action items that you can take in terms of blood lab. But really, when we think about sugar, it's maybe hopefully if you've been listening to this and you're like, hot damn, like I don't want wrinkles and or cataracts and or no energy. Like I want to be training to be the best grandma that I can and joining Stephanie because I already know that Stephanie's in the race. That's me. I am in the race to be the best grandmother ever for my kids. Maybe you want to think about trying to reduce your consumption of fructose. And while labeling issues on foods are really, really, like, they don't necessarily have to delineate what, they can just put carbohydrates. They don't have to put what kind of carbohydrates. You can really mostly eliminate your fructose consumption by consuming whole foods. And I know that that can, it's easier said than done. And of course, there are certain areas of the world where, you know, it's harder to get whole foods. It's much easier to buy processed foods. But the end, you know, in terms of what you can do here is vote with your fork. Instead of waiting every 4 years or however long your election cycle is where you're listening, you know, instead of going out and voting for a candidate, vote with your fork, vote with your wallet. You know, and this is the most beautiful thing about this is that your vote is tallied immediately. If you shop at a certain grocery store and they notice all of a sudden that there are more vegetables being purchased, well, they are going to rise up and meet that demand by purchasing more vegetables. And if they see, for example, that a boxed, you know, I don't know, some boxed, you know, crackers or chips or cookies or whatever are not doing well, then they are going to put it on sale, sell it off, and not restock it. And the great thing about this is that you get to vote, you know, if let's say you have 3 meals a day, you know, and 7 days in a week, you vote 21 times a week, right? Every meal you're voting. And, you know, if you have access to, if you're lucky enough to have access to a local butcher or a local farmer's market or, you know, a fishmonger, like go and shop there. Avoid the big box stores because so often, even though we didn't get into it in this podcast, but so often they will claim it is, you know, Alaskan pollock or, you know, whatever it is. And it's really not from Alaska. It's from, you know, somewhere in China or whatever, or wherever it is, and not necessarily, you know, blaming China, although a different topic, different story, different time. But we want to be thinking about shopping local, supporting your local mom and pop shops. They have been hit incredibly hard. And you know, food is in sometimes food is expensive, and I'm not, you know, I'm not saying that money isn't important. Money is absolutely important. And I think that one of the things that I've been talking about with my team is talking about how to help my women or anybody who wants to learn about money and wealth creation. There's some things in the works there. I can't say too much about it now, but you know, one way or another, you're going to pay, right? You can pay the farmer, you can pay your local mom-pa grocer, local mom-pa butcher, or you can pay the doctor, right? There's going to be someone is being paid. I would prefer to pay the local shop. And I know that I have incredible, you know, living in a city where there's a lot of options. Of course, I feel very blessed and lucky to live in the city and the area that I do. But like I said, it's not like the only option is ever going to be only chips and crackers and cookies and nothing else. So I encourage you to think about that. I invite you to think about that. Maybe you agree with me, maybe you don't. I'd love to hear either way. And I hope that you found this this episode useful. I hope that you found it valuable in terms of the science-y geekiness that I didn't quite intend to go into, but went into anyway. And I hope that it's given you some actionable items around reducing fructose consumption, voting with your fork, and then if you need to get some labs to kind of understand where you are, which labs that you can go speak to your primary healthcare provider about. All right, my Betties, thank you so much for listening this far in, and we will see you very soon.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode. For those of you who want to continue on this week's Geeky Magic Carpet ride with me, visit bettershow.co/show notes. You'll find research, links, summary notes, musings that I prepared in preparation for the podcast, and I often throw in some of my best practices, bonuses, and links. All the juicy bits are in there for you. And now for the obligatory legal and medical disclaimer.
This podcast is for general information only, and the advice recommendations we discuss do not replace medicine, chiropractic, or any other primary healthcare provider's advice, treatment, or care. In the consumption of this podcast, there is no doctor-patient relationship formed. And the use and implementation of the information discussed are at the sole discretion of the listener. The information and opinions shared on this podcast are not intended to be a substitute for primary care, diagnosis, or treatment. This episode is brought to you by yours truly, Dr. Stephanie Estima, and Leverage. Leverage handles all production, creates the images that you see on my social media, and takes out all my awkward pauses. They are my secret magic bullet. You can visit them at getleverage.com/better.